I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Marylanders woke up this morning to high winds and even some snow flurries in some areas, but consider this. The Orioles are well into spring training, and Maryland's June primary elections are just 3 months away. Today, we begin a series of conversations with the candidates. First up, Alec Ross. He's an author and innovation expert who lives in Baltimore City. He's one of 9 Democrats running in the primary for governor. This is the first time he has pursued elective office. Can his expertise in innovation translate into political leadership? And if he defeats the crowded field in June, does he have what it takes to beat a very popular incumbent governor? Alec Ross joins me for the hour here in Studio A when Midday gets underway right after these headlines. And good afternoon on this windy Friday. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Let me give you an update on our weather forecast. There is a high wind warning in effect until 6 o'clock tomorrow morning. Over on the lower eastern shore of Maryland, you all could have wind gusts of up to 75 miles an hour. And there could be gusts as high as 70 miles an hour here in the Baltimore metropolitan area. There are reports of more than 158,000 power outages across the state. BGE is reporting more than 30,000 power outages in the metro area, including many of those in the city of Baltimore. Today on Midday, we explore whether or not the winds of change will be blowing through Annapolis come November as we begin a series of conversations with the candidates who will be on the June 26th primary ballot here in Maryland. Between now and the election, I'll be talking with Democrats who are running in the gubernatorial primary, as well as the Democrats and Republicans who are running for Baltimore County Executive and candidates in a few other races as well. Today, my guest is Alec Ross. Last April, he became the first person to announce his candidacy in the Democratic primary for governor. Since then, 8 others have joined him on that ballot. Alec Ross is an innovation expert and the author of the New York Times best-selling book, The Industries of the Future, about innovation and the changes that economies and societies can expect over the next decade. Alec Ross served in the State Department as Senior Advisor on Innovation to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. He also worked in the Obama campaign and transition team in 2008. He is a former Distinguished Senior Fellow at Johns Hopkins University. He's 46 years old. He and his wife, who's a teacher in the Baltimore City Schools, live in Baltimore, and they have 3 children. Alec Ross joins me in Studio A. It's good to see you. Welcome back.
Thanks, Tom. It's great to be here.
And we are streaming live on the WIPR Facebook page. We will get to your calls and comments in the second part of the show. So, Alec Ross, there are 4 other candidates in the race here who, like you, do not have any experience in elective office. So let's start with a couple of things. Why do you aspire to elective office in general? And why do you want to be the governor in particular?
Sure. I want to be in elected office because I think that talent exists in every zip code in Maryland, but opportunity is not. And I think our politics and our governance desperately need new faces and new ideas. The same old just have not produced the change in our politics or governance that we need. I'm interested in that I haven't come through the sort of Annapolis farm system of politics. But as you mentioned, I do have pretty substantial experience in politics and government. I ran tech policy for Barack Obama's presidential campaign. That went pretty well. And then I had a pretty huge book of business serving in the executive branch of the Obama administration. So lots of government experience. And the reason, honestly, why I'm running now, why run for governor and run now, Alec, it really principally comes down to education. Whoever is elected governor next is going to have a once every 15-year opportunity to reset how we finance education and education policy. That is going to have enormous, enormous consequence.
Why once every 15 years?
It's crazy. We haven't revised our education funding formula since the Thornton Commission, you know, some 13, 14, 15 years ago. This is very hard work. It happens once every 10 to 15 years. It's of grand consequence. I don't agree with it. But when you know that something's coming up, that's a once every 15-year opportunity to try to establish a greater degree of equity in education, that's a good reason to run for governor. And I think that there's going to be a big difference between whether Alec Ross is governor or Larry Hogan's governor.
There are other folks in the race. I haven't talked to him yet. You're our first person in this series of conversations with all of the candidates. But I'll bet dollars to donuts that when I talk to some of them, they're going to say experience in an executive branch of government, for example, as a county executive or people who, you know, you have at least one candidate who's currently in the state Senate, matters. And how do you respond to people who say, look, if you want to get into politics, that's terrific, but why start with the highest office in the state? Why not, as you say, work yourself up? You call it the Annapolis farm system. What's the advantage to that?
So first of all, I would agree with them. I think executive branch experience does matter. I served in the executive branch of the Obama administration. There were projects I had with thousands of employees, hundreds of millions of dollars of budget. So just because I'm not part of the old political establishment does not mean that I am new to this. I would put my executive branch experience up against any other candidate. What we did in the Obama administration in the executive branch with thousands of employees and hundreds of millions of dollars of taxpayer dollars, I'm very proud of. And I'll put that against, you know, what people have done in Prince George's County or Baltimore County or as a state senator any day of the week. I think people want new faces and new ideas with relevant experience. That's what Alec Ross is bringing.
All right. Obviously, you and the other candidates are going to do everything you can to distinguish yourself. And those distinctions between you and Governor Larry Hogan are, I think, going to be pretty easy to draw. How about drawing distinguishing things between you and the other people in the Democratic race? This is a primary election, and Democrats have to decide, you know, number one, who has the best chance of beating Mr. Hogan, if that's in fact their aspiration. But number two, what's the difference between you and the other eight?
Let me break it down. The race for the Democratic primary for governor, it's 1968 versus 1998 versus 2018. There are a couple candidates who want you to click your heels together like Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz and say there's no time like 1968. Good old-fashioned 1968, regressive, old Democratic policies. There are a couple other candidates who there's not so much as a comma's difference between what comes out of their mouth and what Democratic Party doctrine was in 1998. Alec Ross and Julie Virotti are the candidates of the future. We're focused on what's next. You know, we are not fighting the tired old battles of the Democratic Party. Is the 1968 model better, the Bernie Sanders model, or is the Bill Clinton model of 1998 better? We're focused on the future. That sets me apart from every other candidate in this field who's either 1968 or 1998.
But you're on the Democratic ticket.
So
it's a Democratic Party, and there are party loyalists from all of those eras who are active and who are going to be out there voting, and they were voting in 1968 and in 1998 and 2008. Are there basic constructs, basic premises of the Democratic platform that you disavow?
I don't know about disavowing. First of all, I think that the politics of 1968 were appropriate to the 1968 and the politics of 1998 were appropriate to 1998. But people who are voting in 1968 and 1998, I think will all concede, my goodness, the world is changing fast. And my goodness, we need to do some things differently. And so from my standpoint, my running mate and I, Julie Virotti and I, are running with progressive values and business sense. So it's really a set of social values that are pretty far left, and we're very proud of it when it comes to issues of diversity and pluralism, when it comes to women's rights, when it comes to stewarding our environment. We're pretty far to the left. But by the same token, we also understand the virtue and value of entrepreneurship and really focusing on small business growth in Maryland. So Alec Ross and Julie Virotti are all about progressive values and business sense. That's our lane.
As I mentioned, when Democrats go to the polls in June, which is both a long time away, it's 3 months from now, and on the other hand, it's right around the corner, it's 3 months from now, they got to make a decision about which of the nine candidates on that ballot are best positioned to beat a very popular incumbent governor. He's the second most popular governor in the United States of America. He's one of five very popular governors across the country. He will have somewhere, estimates are around $10 million to run a campaign. What makes you best positioned to take on what will surely be a formidable opponent?
So I think that you need a new face with new ideas to take on Larry Hogan. If you put, you know, yesterday's establishment Democratic nominee up against him, you get two versions of the status quo. I don't think that's going to excite voters. I think that you need a fresh face with fresh ideas. I also think you need somebody who's going to run statewide. I find a lot of fault. You asked earlier, where do I fall outside of Democratic Party doctrine? Let me be really critical of the Democrats for a moment. First of all, I think that we have done way too little to focus on those among us who aren't going to college. The Democratic Party has become far too elite and elitist a party. And, you know, look, I grew up in coal country. I'm a former sixth grade public school teacher in Baltimore City. My wife's a public school teacher in Baltimore City. My three kids go to public schools in Baltimore City. And what I'm going to do with my candidacy is reconnect with those voters in the state who have been largely ignored. Most people who, if you look back in 2014, folks running for governor, they didn't get off the I-95 corridor. They didn't speak to anybody other than their core voters. I am really focused on running statewide. The kind of thing that we did with Barack Obama, by the way, when I was running tech policy for that campaign, where we didn't just send him into inner cities, we also sent him out to the rural parts of the state. We also did the good old-fashioned work of persuasion. And so my campaign is going to be really distinct in that we are running in all 24 jurisdictions in the state.
Are the voters you're talking about the voters who are often thought of as the Trump voters, you know, these disillusioned, disenfranchised white voters who are on the lower end of the economic scale? They are not living in the cities. They're living in the rural parts of the state and around the country. Is that the demo you're talking about?
I mean, that's a little piece of it. What I think is the much larger piece are people who aren't voting. Donald Trump was elected by people 50 years old and older. If people under 40 had voted at the same level of participation as people above the age of 50, Donald Trump would have lost in a landslide. So I wouldn't make the binary Trump voters versus non-Trump voters. I think that there are a lot of real progressive young people who just don't connect with the county executives or with, you know, somebody who in Annapolis has been a part of the old Annapolis establishment. So for a lot of people, I think it's going to be first-time voters or infrequent voters, somebody who says, yes, you know, this is somebody who's running for office, who realizes he only has one mouth, but he has two ears, and he hears my concerns and he understands them.
You're an innovation expert. That's how you're sort of, you know, quickly and summarily defined. I, for one, have no idea what an innovation expert
Neither
is.
Neither do I. I don't think I call myself that, but I guess it's nice that others do.
But I mean, when people want to know what it is that you're really good at, how would you answer that?
It's imagining and inventing the future. You know, I wrote this book, The Industries of the Future, good long run in the New York Times bestseller list, just published in its 18th language. And it's because, look, I may not be the smartest guy in the room, but I do know what's coming around the corner. And part of why I'm running for governor is that when I think about the future, I take a neither utopian nor dystopian view. I don't think the future is going to be Star Trek, you know, lives of happiness, health, wealth, and abundance, lacking for nothing. But I also don't think it's going to be Mad Max. There's promise and there's peril. And what Alec Ross is best at is understanding the forces that are shaping the future technologically, scientifically, geopolitically, and then knowing what to do about it. So what people can count on is with me as governor is it's not going to be the sleepy old status quo sort of nibbling at the edges of these problems, which both Democrats and Republicans do. There's going to be a measure of boldness there. And this is not a hypothetical based on a theoretical based on a maybe. We brought a lot of this boldness into the Obama administration. I helped set up about 5% of the Economic Recovery Act. That's $35, $36 billion worth of programs, billions with a B. It was hugely successful. Nobody thought we were going to accomplish what we did. So what I want to do is continue the kind of track record I had in the Obama administration and bring some of that giddy up to Maryland, bring some of that giddy up to Annapolis.
Well, but there are folks who would also say it wasn't so hugely successful, that the recession lasted longer than it needed to, that the recovery was extremely slow and it took way longer than many other recoveries have taken. I mean, isn't that sort of a glass half full, a glass half empty understanding of the world? Different perspectives will come up with a different summary of how well TARP worked or how well the investment reenactment or whatever that was called, the Reinvestment Act,
sure,
worked. I mean, and how do you answer the folks who say, no, it wasn't so good, it took too long?
I would say the programs that I worked on, which I was not in charge of all $781 billion worth of programs. I set up about $35 billion worth of programs. they were great. You know, not so much as a hiccup. You know, we helped massively accelerate broadband penetration in the country. For those of us, if you look at your cell phone and you see something on there that says LTE, you know, we helped build those mobile broadband networks across the country in part through these programs. Electronic health records, you know, the science and tech investments that we made in the Obama administration, A plus. And I don't think anybody would say anything else.
All right, we're going to take a break. We will come back and have more with Alec Ross. He is one of 9 Democrats running in the June primary for the chance to face Governor Larry Hogan in the general election come November. He is an innovation expert, according to people who write that down in magazines and such. And he's the author of the book, The Industries of the Future. If you have a question for Alec Ross, you'll have a chance to ask it when we come back from a break. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday at WIPR.org. Our Twitter handle at @MiddayWYPR. We are broadcasting and streaming on Facebook on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Midday here on your NPR news station, 88.1. WYPR.
And welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us here on Midday. By the way, coming up Monday on our program, we continue our series of conversations with the candidates. State Senator Jim Brochin will be my guest. He's a Democrat running for Baltimore County Executive, plus Kamau High, the editor of the Baltimore Afro newspaper, joins me for the Afro Check-In. That's coming up Midday on Monday. If you're just joining us today, my guest is Alec Ross. He's one of 9 Democrats who are running in the primary for governor of Maryland. Many of those candidates will join us on Midday before early voting begins on June 14th. You are welcome to be part of our conversation today. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday at WIPR.org. Our Twitter handle, at midday WIPR. And we are streaming on the WIPR Facebook page. So, Alec Ross, in your book, which I enjoyed, you mentioned five or six industries that are going to be key to the future: robotics, genetics, the codification of money, cybersecurity, and the harnessing of big data. So, what is the capacity of a governor, or you as the putative governor of the state, to build those particular industries or industries like them in our state? What can the governor do as an individual, and what should the state be doing collectively to, as you say, move into the future with the jobs and the in an economy where the nature of work in general, you make the argument that the nature of work is going to be different in 2028 than it is in 2018.
So what's interesting is Maryland is already extremely well positioned for the industries of the future. It might surprise some of our listeners to know that Maryland today has the highest per capita household income of any state in the United States of America. We are number 1 out of 50. We are the home of the NIH, the NSA, the Goddard Space Center, Johns Hopkins, the University of Maryland, a big biotech corridor on 270. We're actually wonderfully well positioned for this. But it is insufficiently inclusive. You know, I was a sixth grade teacher at Booker T. Washington Middle School on the west side of Baltimore, and I know that there was genius in my classroom. I know that the genius in my sixth grade classroom at Booker T. Washington Middle School was equal to the genius that sat across the table from me in the White House Situation Room. What can a governor do to generate more inclusive innovation? What a governor can do is what I am proposing, which is a $1 billion investment over 4 years to generate more inclusive innovation. So in Maryland, for example, let's just take one of the 5 industries that you mentioned, cybersecurity. Today, as you and I sit here, Tom, there are 20,000 open cybersecurity jobs just in Maryland, with an average starting salary of $95,000 a year, the vast majority of which don't require a college degree. 20,000 openings, but what we don't have—
What do they require?
They require different certification programs, network administration and maintenance. It's more like a year to 2 years worth of apprenticeships or training, things that can be done in a community college, things that can be done in a public-private partnership through apprenticeships. And so what I want to do is, if we are creating $1 trillion industries of the future, I want more people from more zip codes to be a part of it. And so what the governor can do is create an inclusive innovation agenda, basically to make sure that the outputs of our education system map to the inputs of where all of these open jobs are. I think that there are there's abundant talent out there, but too much of it is working at or around minimum wage, and there isn't really a clear path into these job openings. So what the governor can do is create that path.
You mentioned education as one of the big animators of your decision to run for governor. We have a number of comments about education coming in on the Facebook live stream. Seth asks, what are the details of your educational platform? What do you see should happen there? Matt says, what about affordable higher education in Maryland?
So first to Seth, I appreciate that question. I'm not one for tweet-sized public policy. You got to get beyond the 140 characters. So if you go to alecross.com, the Baltimore Sun recently reported that my campaign is the only one putting out detailed policy proposals. If you go to alecross.com, click on issues. For everything that I spout off about here on the radio, there's a big white paper behind it. And so there are 10 pages undergirding my education.
Give us the highlights.
You know, first of all, universal computer science education. Computer code is the alphabet that much of the future is going to be written in. Today's students need to be fluent in that alphabet. Only 40% of public schools in Maryland offer computer science. What that means...
So coding, the ability to code is going to be important for everybody, not just the ability to use your iPad or use your PC.
That's right. Technology is no longer just a slice of the pie. It's the pan. It is a part of every industry. And when only 40% of public schools are offering computer science, what that means is that the kids at the 60% of schools are being educated to bust the tables and fold the bedsheets of that 40%. And it's overwhelmingly the whiter and wealthier schools that have computer science education. So there's a big one. The second thing is a focus not just on K-12, but focusing on those among us who aren't going to go to college. I think, again, that the Democratic Party has been too elitist and has ignored people who just aren't going to go to college. The rhetoric and policies of the Democratic Party for the last 20, 30 years have been, if you go to college, you're a winner. If you don't go to college, you're a loser. I want Maryland to be the white-hot center of apprenticeships to help people get into the skilled trades, the maritime trades, the building trades, plumbers, electricians. We have labor deficits in these areas, but they're dignified jobs. They're good, well-paying jobs. And yet the average age of a master plumber in Maryland is 61. The average age of a certified electrician is 59. We have to have Democrats who care about those among us who aren't going to go to college.
Kalia asks, what is your plan, your actual plan, to ensure educational policies are established with community and take a race equity lens? Using the equity word is now a platitude short on specifics. His 1968 to 2018 rhetoric means little to people on the ground. What's new about what you're planning? That comes from
money.
Kalia.
At the end of the day, you know, you can string all the words together that you want. At the end of the day, how do you allocate resources? Since Larry Hogan has become governor, the percentage of the state budget for education has gone from 21% to 18%. In 2015, he withheld $68 million in education funding. In 2016, he withheld $25 million in education funding. I will take the state budget and reorient it back to education, get it back to 21%. And if you look at those places that have been hit the hardest, as the questioner asked, a lot of it is rooted in race and in income. Those places that have been starved of resources include Baltimore City, where I taught, where my wife teaches, where my kids go to school. So the simple answer to your question is money. We need to get resources into these schools so that instead of having near 40 students in a classroom, I sure would like for our classrooms to have class sizes that look more like Montgomery County and Howard County, where you've got, you know, closer to 30 students in a classroom. I don't find fault with Howard County or Montgomery County. It's to their great credit that there's that level of investment in education. But Baltimore City and other lower-income rural counties have gotten hammered. I'm going to change that, and you change that with resources.
Your call for inclusive innovation, you put a price tag on that of about $1 billion. So obviously a lot of people are going to say allocating is one thing, but coming up with the revenue is another. It's a multi-billion dollar budget we're talking about with the state, but this is a new program you're talking about. So to add $1 billion to it, how do you do that?
So first, it's $1 billion over 4 years, which comes to about one half of 1% of the annual budget. It's a $43 billion annual budget in Maryland. And I think that how you spend that money is an expression of your values. I will flag one thing that I think is going to, that the projections are will bring in more than that in revenue. I want to legalize and regulate recreational marijuana. Right now, $800 million a year goes into the pockets of drug gangs. And the impact of this on issues of racial justice. It's disproportionately people of color who are being arrested with dime bags or who are caught up in violence that's associated with the drug trade, including marijuana, not able to get jobs decades ahead if you're caught with a dime bag when you're 19 years old. I think prohibition has failed. I want to take that $800 million a year worth of activity that's in the marijuana trade in Maryland right now. I want to bring it above board. I want to tax it. That will then bring a couple hundred million dollars worth of revenue.
And let's talk then about the political reality or the political chances of that, probability of that, because look what's been going on with medical marijuana, how long it's taken to get those licenses issued and allocated in a fair and racially equitable way, how long it's taken to get that program going. And that's just a tiny little thing compared to recreational marijuana. I mean, how do you as a politician, because if you're the governor, you're in the you're a political figure, how do you convince our legislature to all of a sudden magically approve recreational marijuana?
Learn from your failures. I mean, if you look at who have these medical marijuana licenses, it's a bunch of politically well-connected rich guys who are donors to Larry Hogan. I think it's obnoxious. By the way, the communities of color that have, and predominantly African-American communities that have been disproportionately impacted by the criminalization of marijuana, for the licenses to go to basically 100% white owners, that's obnoxious. It's obscene. So what would I do? I would make this like alcohol sales. Instead of just cherry picking a sort of oligarchy of people who will grow rich on this, if you actually look at the health data, alcohol does much more harm to your body and has a much more negative impact on society, on public health issues, than marijuana. I would have a distribution network for recreational marijuana that looks like that for alcohol. It is regulated. You have to. It is licensed, but it doesn't flow through nine companies or something like this. I find that the model that was put in place by today's politicians, Democrat and Republican, to have failed. And this is part of yet another reason why I don't think we should go back to the same old politicians who have failed us to this point, who have very little experience in business. And we shouldn't go back to them to try to right this wrong.
Alec Ross is my guest here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Alec Ross is one of nine Democrats vying for the chance to face Larry Hogan in the November election for governor of the state of Maryland. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. We are streaming on our Facebook page at WYPR, and you can find us in the Twittersphere at @MiddayWYPR. Here's a comment on Twitter from Melissa. And this is a good question, and I'm glad that she's suggested posing it to you. She says, innovation is great, but we lack basics in our city for our children, especially children of color. I'd like my fourth grader to code or whatever, but heat and air conditioning come first. We need to have a hierarchy of the needs for all. When you talk about innovation, you talk about, you know, kids learning coding and stuff. That does sound really good. But boy, if you're a single mom in Sandtown, Winchester, and it's impossible for you to get to a grocery store very easily to feed healthy foods to your three kids, that just seems like so far in the stratosphere.
Well, I taught those kids in Sandtown, and my son goes to a high school, right now a public high school in Baltimore, when if it gets cold outside, the kids wear their coats. So, look, I'm one of those parents. I was one of those teachers. You know, I'm one of you. I feel it. What ought to be the case, though, is that our public schools in Baltimore, they should be cathedrals. I mean, when I was teaching sixth grade at Booker T. Washington Middle School, I had a single set of textbooks, 35 textbooks, and I would have to teach 3-4 classes with that single set of textbooks, meaning that kids didn't get to take the book home. There was no homework, using the textbooks when you only got one set. So we have to meet the basic needs of these students. That goes back to the earlier part of our conversation about equity and about putting real capital behind it. But the other thing that I know about these kids in Sandtown, Tom, is that they do have the ability to get jobs where there's going to be job growth. I think it is horrendous for us to say, well, for an African-American kid from West Baltimore, that kid in West Baltimore is never going to make it to the West Wing. That kid in West Baltimore is never going to make it working for a cybersecurity company. Wrong. Wrong. What we need to do is invest. Of course, there needs to be basic infrastructure, like the heating and cooling of our schools. And oh, by the way, nothing irritates my wife and I more than to have to send our son to school with a big old winter coat so he can stay warm during class. But by the same token, I want us to be able to dream big for our kids, because I do know, having taught kids from Sandtown, the genius is there. I know West Baltimore, but I've also worked in the West Wing, and I'm telling you, the kids in West Baltimore have the same God-given talent. They just don't have the same opportunities.
A couple of comments about the Red Line and State Center. One of them comes from Klaus Philipson, who's a very well-known architect and urban planner. He's been on the show a few times. Obviously, Governor Hogan's decision to not do the Red Line here in Baltimore, very controversial, and his decision to delay or defer or change somehow the development at State Center, also very controversial. What are the chances of reviving either or both of those projects?
Well, first, these people who say, oh, Larry Hogan, he's not so bad, he's a nice guy, I'd like to have beer with him, that's such nonsense. He's Chris Christie. He comes off, oh, look at him with his Ray-Bans. He seems like a nice guy. But what has he done? He has systematically withheld investment in Baltimore. The shutdown of the Red Line, let me tell you why the Red Line got shut down in Baltimore. Because the people who it would have principally helped are African-Americans who didn't vote for him. I really think that race and politics are at the core of it.
Yeah, and you're not the only one to think that. And that's a widely held view. But that was then, this is now.
Right.
Is it possible to revive the Red Line, having had the governor turn down, nearly $1 billion in federal funding?
Yes to the Red Line, and yes to State Center. You got to get started. We sent $900 million back. We have to start from scratch. We cannot just curl into the fetal position and say, oh, we missed our window. No, it will begin a multi-year process. Larry Hogan has been governor for 3 years, so we just lost 3 years. If we elect a Democrat, then we can recommit ourselves to the multi-year process of bringing mass transit, bringing public transit back to Baltimore. Now, a governor does not get to just snap his fingers and hello, 21st century public transit is in Baltimore. No, it is a multi-year process, but we are now living with the negative consequence of having a Chris Christie clone as our governor, who everybody thinks is so nice and thinks he's so sympathetic, but systematically divests in communities like Baltimore. And just like Chris Christie, it'll get substantially worse if he is reelected and doesn't even have to try to pretend anymore.
How about State Center?
State Center, the failure to invest in State Center made absolutely no sense. This has been studied and studied and studied, and the economic case for State Center, I think, was very clearly made. The
governor would tell you, by the way, and he was on the show just a while ago, and he said it was a bad deal for the state. He said he's, living up to his fiduciary responsibility to make sure that we're not wasting money. There were things like the parking garage and the fees that people were going to have to pay and the rents and stuff were going to be absorbent. So
Larry Hogan thinks any deal for Baltimore is a bad deal for the state, because what Larry Hogan cares about the parts of the state where people vote for him. He cares about the parts of the state that are overwhelmingly white and rural. Larry Hogan does not care about Black Baltimore. Larry Hogan does not care about Baltimore at all. So he might be able to put a more, might be able to, you know, smile and aw shucks, and I'm just being a good steward of taxpayer resources. You want to know what he thinks being a good steward of taxpayer resources is? Is taking taking money from inside of Baltimore, taking it outside of Baltimore. That's what he cares about.
And you have particular ways, particular scenarios that you can envision that you, as a governor, would be able to convince the legislature, including everybody from Montgomery County, PG County, Prince George's County, Charles County, St. Mary's County, the state, that investing in Baltimore is a good idea, because there's an awful lot of people from outside this metropolitan area who think it's not a good idea. Hogan is not alone in that regard.
He's not. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think that having traveled every nook and cranny of this state, there are some people who look at Baltimore with contempt and cannot be convinced that a nickel that goes into Baltimore is a nickel spent well. But I think that by and large, what people want is good stewardship of taxpayer resources. Baltimore is the economic engine for Maryland. And investing in Baltimore does not have to come at the expense of the rest of the state. The rest of the state benefits from a healthier, wealthier Baltimore. And I think that that's a majority view, and I think it's a view held by most people in the General Assembly.
Alec Ross is a Democratic candidate who hopes to be the next governor of Maryland. He lives here in Baltimore, and he's my guest this afternoon on Midday here in Studio A. We are streaming live on the WIPR Facebook page. You can find us on Twitter at @MiddayWIPR. You can find us in email, midday@WIPR.org, and to call in 410-662-8780. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we'll go to Angela in West Baltimore. So, Angela, hang tight. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, Alec Ross is here. He is one of 9 Democrats running for governor of Maryland. He is an innovation expert, so-called, and a Baltimore City resident, and the author of the book, The Industries of the Future. He will be joined on the June primary ballot by Rashern Baker, Kevin Kamenetz, Ben Jealous, Richard Modaleno, Jim Shea, Krish Vignaraja, and 2 other candidates. If you have a question for Alec Ross, our phone number, 410-662-8780, our email, midday@WIPR.org, and our Twitter handle, @MiddayWIPR. You can also catch us streaming live on the WIPR Facebook page. Let's go to Angela in West Baltimore. Welcome to the show with Alec Ross.
Thank you. Hi, Tom. Hi, Alec. I wanted to address the concept of innovation. And, I think a lot of people misconstrue innovation for simply throwing more money into IT or things of that nature. And especially when it comes to education and focusing on uplifting our young people, innovation can look like just as easy, or not really easy, but can look like arming our educators and the people who come in direct contact with our youth with how to deal with trauma. You know, we have a whole community of children who are traumatized. They're not dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder. They're dealing with continuous traumatic stress disorder. Being exposed to violence one time has an effect on your brain. So think of what our children go through when they have to walk past a street corner where their cousin has been shot and killed, or someone in their neighborhood or someone in their family was a victim of gun violence. They don't have the option of having a new school built for them because they're in their community. They live in their community. Their community is the source of their stress and their trauma. So it's really the elephant in the room that no one's really dealing with when it comes to our youth. You can't sit children in a room and expect them to learn when you're not helping them to cope with the trauma that they've been born into. Of Not all children deal with the same thing, but, you know, we have too many of our kids who are traumatized, and their issues are being ignored.
That's an excellent point, Angela. Excellent point. And again, it comes down to what is the capacity of the office of governor and the individual who holds that office.
That's right. And so let me first thank Angela for sharing that. My, you know, as I shared, I was a teacher at Booker T. Washington Middle School on the West Side, and my wife continues to teach in Baltimore City Public Schools. And we started making a list of our students who had been killed in gun violence, not kids in the schools where we taught, but students who we personally taught. And we stopped at 10. We didn't want to keep going. So my wife and I, you know, we've seen the effect of gun violence in these classrooms. So the trauma that Angela describes is very real. And I'm glad she tied this to the concept of innovation, because sort of whiz-bang technology, like, that's not going to help anybody. That's not going to help everybody, and that's not a solution to all the problems. But as Angela said, if we can think about how to better equip our educators, our social workers, and others with tools and help them innovate in dealing with things like trauma, it can have a real impact. And the last point I would make on this is, if you asked me right now, Alec, if what would make Baltimore a safer, healthier place in 10 years? Hiring 1,000 teachers and counselors, or hiring 1,000 police officers? All of you listening, ask yourself that question. What would make Baltimore a safer, healthier place in 10 years? If we hired 1,000 teachers and counselors now, or if we hired 1,000 police officers? If you want to know what kind of Governor Alec Ross would be, he's one who would answer saying, 1,000 teachers and counselors. And as governor, that's what I want to do. It's educate or incarcerate. It's invest in our kids, or we are going to stay in this cycle of violence and a lack of economic opportunity. There's connective tissue between these things.
But it's, of course, always a matter of priorities, because an awful lot of people in the state legislature, including the Democratic president of the Senate and the Democratic leader of the House, say, you know, you just can't have everything. So if it's $1 billion you're proposing for innovation inclusion, does that exclude what you might be able to invest in early childhood education? I bring this up constantly, but the city of New York is educating every three-year-old, pretty much all five boroughs, rich and poor. They are getting put in safe environments. They're getting well-fed. They're getting the naps when they need them. They're getting the instruction that they need them. They're going to kindergarten knowing a little bit about their numbers and their colors, and they're able to start succeeding at age five because they've had universal pre-K. Why is the murder rate in New York so much less than the murder rate is in the city of Baltimore? Well, that has to have something to do with it.
It does. And let me tell you, the expression of our values, let's not talk about spending any more money, Tom. All right, we have a $43.4 billion budget in a state of 6 million people. How you spend that money is an expression of your values. And I think I've been pretty clear about where my values are. My values are on education and inclusion. If you want sort of the good old boys...
But will a Ross administration have a $48 billion budget, or will you be able to do what you want to do within the confines of what we generally have as revenue now?
Do what we want to do within the confines of what we have revenue now. You know, I'm sorry. Let's just talk about technology. If you walk into a typical state office building in Annapolis right now, turn on a desktop computer, I'll find a couple hundred dollars worth of waste right there on that desktop
computer.
Because
of outdated IT.
Oh, it's just ridiculous. It's insane how we spend money. And it's because a bunch of people who have no understanding of this stuff are locking ourselves into these 10-year agreements with this, you know, terrible old software licenses. It's ridiculous. Look, if you want your...
So the kinds of IT savings alone that you speculate we can have amounts to about what? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, a couple billion dollars. Look, we...
Really, $2 billion fixing the software and the IT that we have.
Over 5 years, yes. And again, this isn't... I'm not just spouting off. We did this in the Obama administration. You know, Alec Ross and my team, we have a track record on this. We went from closed, proprietary, you know, multi-year licenses to open source and in the cloud, we saved the American taxpayers multiple billions of dollars. We do that in Annapolis. Again, I just want to do the same thing that I did in the Obama administration and do it in Annapolis. We've got the playbook down.
All right. We have a call from Maxine in Baltimore. Maxine, welcome to Midday with Alec Ross.
Thank you. I'm wondering about finances in Baltimore City. You're speaking a lot about putting money into the city education. I'm very much in favor of that. But lots of money has been put to the city. And what happened to it? And the new head of the school system does not know. How do you monitor the funds that have been allocated to the city?
That's a great question, Maxine. So first, I think that there's a deal that a Democrat can cut with the Baltimore City Public Schools. I think that we can help enhance, you attach conditionality to the dollars that you allocate to the city and to the public school system in exchange for some enhancements in governance. Now, let me tell you, Sonia Santelises, the comparatively new superintendent of Baltimore City Public Schools, she's made a really positive impression on me. I mean, if you look at the amount of money that is being, the reductions in aid. So just last month, in, you know, at the beginning of February, Hogan proposed a $42 million reduction in aid to Baltimore City Public Schools. So Dr. Santelises is managing an environment, since she's been superintendent, of, you know, tens of millions of dollars walking out the door. So I do have confidence in her. And what I think is that she needs a partner in the governor, and I think she needs some additional tools in terms of governance.
We have an email from a former teacher, Margaret, who says, I taught in what would be called failing schools in Baltimore County. My experience shows that more focus needs to be put on parenting skills and social and basic development programs at the elementary level. By the time the students reach me in middle and high school, they didn't have the ability to persevere, to accept constructive criticism, and see that they need not live the lives of their parents. They need opportunities to learn the abstract skills in their middle and upper middle class peers already bring to the first days of school to make academic achievement possible. Let's not put the cart before the horse. And again, this speaks to the issue of, can the government do that? Is the government at the state level, the local level, the national level positioned to improve parenting skills?
Yeah, I don't think it's the job of the government of the state of Maryland to parent children. I do think that there are things that the government can support. For example, the community schools model, which is proving to work well, which helps bring parents into the schools. I think that the state can also do a lot of good helping to strengthen our mental health infrastructure, for example. I think that we are in what is effectively a mental health crisis in Maryland. And I think that we need to make sure that there is a mental health infrastructure that can help both students and parents. But at the end of the day, I don't think it's the job of the governor or the lieutenant governor to be mommy and daddy to the students, but rather to intelligently invest in the systems that produce programs like community schools and mental health infrastructure.
I can only give you 30 seconds to answer a question from a listener, Tom, who says, what about developing clean energy here in Maryland?
Yeah, we've taken a big step backwards in the last couple of years. One thing that, you know, the O'Malley administration did well is it focused on developing the industry for clean energy in Maryland. That has effectively been shut off. We need to recommit to Maryland being a model of environmental stewardship.
That's all the time we have. You can check out the WYPR Twitter feed to find out some of the other questions we didn't get a chance to get to. You also have a few attaboys on there, Alec Ross. You may want to take a look at them. So thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it. And we will see you as the campaign trail continues.
Thank you, Tom.
Alec Ross is a Democratic candidate for governor. We've got a link to the Alec Ross campaign website at our website, WYPR.org/midday. Early voting in the June primary begins in 104 days. That's it for us today. Coming up Monday, our series of conversations with the candidates continues. State Senator Jim Brochin will be my guest. He's a Democrat running for Baltimore County Executive. Plus, Kamal High of the Afro newspaper joins me for the Afro check-in. That's coming up on Midday Monday. We want to thank Patango Bakery and Cafe for providing lunch today. They're located on South Ann Street in historic Fells Point. They specialize in imported Italian charcuterie and house-made breads and pastries. They're open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. They've got menu and hours on their website, patangogelato.com/bakery. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknell. Luke, the luge, the legend. I don't even know what that means. Rob Sivak, Sienna Greaves, and Kathleen Cahill produce the program. Jamila Krempel is our digital producer. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the midday theme music. We want to thank everybody for listening. Thanks for following us on Twitter. Thanks for downloading our podcast. We very, very much appreciate it. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great weekend.